Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The Cleveland Browns are back in the postseason. The Buffalo Bills are scary as hell. Adam Gase has been fired. Same with Doug Marrone. Unfortunately, Jungle favorite Anthony Lynn as well. Aaron Rodgers better win the MVP. And Arthur Juan Brown is a very bad man. You don't believe me? Then check this reception in the final seconds of a tie game with the division on the line.
Texans set to rush four. He dropped. Tannehill looks. He throws deep downfield. Going for A.J. Brown. He's got it! A.J. Brown makes the catch.
Yes!
Inside
yes!
the 25. My goodness.
That is Titans radio. Man, that was so good. That was so good, the Titans Twitter account had to go full government on Arthur Juan Brown. And they were right to do so. And if that moment were not wild enough, Tennessee had one more in them.
Right hash, 37 yards to win it. Snap, set, Sloman's kick is up. His kick hits the upright and goes through.
Yes!
It's
yes!
Good!
Yes, yes, yes! Great job, Sloman!
Bank shot for Sloman! And the 2020 AFC South champion reside in the 6-1-5.
Great job, Sloman. Great job, core analyst. The only thing better than a doink in football is a successful doink to lock up the division, which is awesome. And speaking of awesome, that is one of the words that you could use to describe Aaron Rodgers yesterday and, in fact, over the course of the entire season. I mean, you can make an argument for Patrick Mahomes for MVP, and that'd be cool, especially considering the fact that Mahomes was rested for Week 17. But when you consider the weapons that each of these guys has, it's not even close. There is no comparison, and there is no argument. You give the MVP to Aaron Rodgers. He led his team to another 13-3 season after everybody had predicted that that team would take a big step back this year. He had four touchdowns yesterday. That gives him 48 for the season against only five INTs. That's the best TD interception ratio of his entire career. He completed better than 70% of his passes, also a career high. And the fact that he's still putting up career highs at this point of his career really is amazing. But then again, knowing Aaron Rodgers, not that surprising. This is how this guy's wired, and this is how this guy approaches everything. This is how you explain him doing things like this.
Third and about four, snap to Rodgers, blitz on. Rodgers lofts it deep down the middle, got a man out there. It's MVS, and he is gone. 10-5, end zone, touchdown, Green Bay Packers, 72 yards.
Packers radio, and that right there is some vintage Aaron Rodgers bleep. And speaking of vintage bleep, let me segue to the Baltimore Ravens. Baltimore Ravens rediscovering themselves at just the right time. I mean, for weeks they did not look like the Baltimore Ravens. They look like a bunch of randos in purple and black. Lately, though, they are looking a lot like the Ravens. And that's a pretty scary prospect for anybody who has to face them. Especially when looking like the Ravens means winning five straight, entering the postseason, and bludgeoning the Bengals for 404 yards on the ground. 400. 400 on the ground. They put them in the ground. Look, I understand that that was the Bengals, but that just does not happen. At least it's not supposed to happen. And it's only happened four times in the past 70 years. And that was just part of a wild day yesterday, which included the Cowboys and the Giants battling for a chance to make the playoffs and looking really ugly in doing so. How ugly? One of the biggest highlights of the game was this.
Hand off for Gallman. He's got a hold. There goes Gallman for a first down. 35, and then he goes down, and he fumbled the football. Gallman raced out into the open.
I think he got back on it.
And he fumbled the football. He was trying to give himself up and go down, and in doing so, he coughed it up.
No, ruling on the field.
Nope, he fumbled it.
Blue was down in possession. It is Blue's ball.
Oh, he has
down.
It.
Oh, he has it between his legs.
Yeah.
When he went down.
He did get it. He got it back.
He's sitting on it.
He hatched the egg.
He has it between his legs.
Yep.
And then the Cowboys come in. Now, here's the thing. The ruling on the field is that Gallman sat on the ball and had possession of it between his legs.
Giants Radio. So the city that gave us the butt fumble just gave us the butt fumble recovery. Except that wasn't even the weirdest moment of the game. Because that was the moment where Cowboys head coach Mike McCarthy saw this play but decided not to challenge it.
Makes it 3rd and 16, and the pass is caught.
Wow, that's a heck of a catch.
4th down, let's see if he caught this.
Yeah, it's close.
I don't know.
His hand initially was under the ball.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Look, I'm not going to tell you that was a no-brainer to challenge that reception. No, I'm not going to do that. But I'll let Fox rules analyst Mike Pereira do it for me. Quote, no question in my mind that if Dallas were to challenge this, it would have been reversed to an incomplete pass. End quote. Instead, McCarthy decides not to challenge. The Giants kick a field goal on the next play. They take a 4-point lead. So the decision was dumb. Really dumb. Yet McCarthy's explanation somehow was even dumber.
The catch, it was obviously down in our area, and the way the receiver turned to me and the information we just felt it was too close. You know, we felt it was a kind of a bang-bang type, you know, situation. And the fact of the matter, we were in a tight game, and the 3 timeouts was obviously of high value there. So we just didn't think there was enough information to overturn it.
Bang. Hey, Mike, how much information do you need to overturn it? The whole point of challenges is that you're challenging a call that is not totally obvious. Because if it were totally obvious, it would have been called correctly in the first place. And yes, I understand the value of 3 timeouts in a tight game. But you know what's even more valuable? You tell me. 3 timeouts or spotting the other team 3 points. You don't get to cash in the timeouts at the end of the game for points. You can't convert timeouts, unused timeouts, into points. So if you're given the choice of burning a timeout to take 3 points off the board in a tight game, you do that every single time. That way, instead of needing a touchdown to win, you can put the game away with a field goal. What you don't do is what you just did. What you don't do is what you always did in Green Bay. Jack up a season with some of the worst game management ever. Clearly, that is not something that you and the other wannabes worked on in that football barn of yours in Wisconsin in your year away from the game. Game management. I mean, seriously, how can that guy, even that guy, not challenge that call in a situation with a potential trip to the postseason hanging in the balance? There's not anybody anywhere not named that guy who didn't know he had a challenge in that situation. Which brings me back to the 2 greatest quotes of the year, the ones that were told to Jane Slater by Cowboy players about Cowboy coaches. Remember? There's the one about the coaches being, quote, totally unprepared. They don't teach. They don't have any sense of adjusting on the fly. And then this sledgehammer, quote, they just aren't good at their jobs, end quote. So after a full season of games, those quotes are now smarter and more accurate than ever. And the Giants winning that game meant that they had a chance to win the division and go to the postseason. They just needed some help from Philadelphia. Help that they did not get. Not at all. I mean, it did look pretty good, right, for a moment, when the Eagles took that 14-10 lead thanks to a pair of Jalen Hurts touchdown runs in the second quarter. But it looked truly terrible when Doug Peterson shocked the world by putting Nate Sudfeld into the game in the fourth quarter of a 1-score game. And the reactions from the Giant players on Twitter when it was going down were incredible. Saquon Barkley, quote, can someone make it make sense to me? What's going on? End quote. Darius Slayton, quote, why on God's green earth is Jalen Hurts not in the game? End quote. Golden Tate tweeted a WTF meme and then, quote, I think the Eagles just hate us more than Washington. That's the only thing that can make sense, right? End quote. Let me say this about the Giants. It was amazing to see the Giants losing their collective minds in real time on social. However, let's get something clear here. The Giants have got nobody to blame but themselves. Sure, it sucks that Doug Peterson suddenly decided to get his third-string quarterback some reps, and I'll get to that in a minute. But if you're the Giants and you win six games in a season, you do not get to complain about anybody doing anything anywhere that kept you out of the postseason. You know why that is? Because you're 6-10. You're 6-10. You don't have anybody to blame for the situation you're in right now but yourselves because you're 6-10. All right? Having gotten that out of the way, let's go back to Peterson for a minute. His explanation for why he wanted to get Nate Sudfeld reps. And I quote, "Nate has been here for 4 years, and I felt that he deserved an opportunity to get some snaps." End quote. Hey, Dougie, the hell is this? Senior night in high school? The guy's been here for 4 years, and he deserves to get some snaps. Like, what kind of high school garbage is that? This is the NFL. You're supposed to try to win every single play, every single game. You're not supposed to be putting third stringers in a one-score game in the fourth quarter. And by the way, the fact that he's been there for 4 years tells you everything. You know who Nate Sudfeld is. He's a third stringer. I mean, maybe a nice guy, I'm sure, but a third stringer. You do not need more information on him. You've got all the data you need. It's Jalen Hurts that you need to be evaluating. You need to know if he's the guy long-term or if you need another quarterback. You already know that Nate is not that guy. You don't need to see him in the final quarter of a January game that your opponent absolutely needs. And listen, I understand that Hurts wasn't exactly tearing it up last night in the second half. But that's why you keep him in there, to see how he responds in a situation like that. So why don't we just call that what it was? A tank job. Peterson can't admit it, but it was. Yes, if he really, truly wanted to tank, he would have rested all his vets and then started Sudfeld from the start. But putting Sudfeld into the game pretty much guaranteed that they would lose that game. You know what that meant? That meant that they would pick sixth instead of ninth, and that does make a difference. I mean, it matters. I get it. The difference between 6 and 9 in the draft is pretty huge. That's big-time value on draft night. Just don't tell me that you did it for any other reason than that. And you sure as hell don't tell us that you were doing everything you could to win that game because you know you weren't. It's absurd. Hey, you want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back that you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically with no limit on how much you can earn. I mean, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you consider all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So, when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations do apply. We are joined by Tremaine Edmonds. Tremaine, really nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing good. Nice to be on.
Really good to have you on. I really appreciate you making time. In fact, let me ask you, what's it like to wake up on a Monday morning after a 30-point win where you got your 13th win of the year?
It's amazing, man. I mean, anytime you get a victory, waking up the next day is always better. But, you know, our minds are set on bigger goals, you know, just to be honest. And just now, you know, everything starts over. So, you know, we got to press the reset button and, you know, get our minds prepared to, you know, go on this playoffs run, and you know, the guys are motivated. I'm motivated, man. It's gonna be fun.
You know, you're one step ahead of me because I was gonna ask you about mindset in the sense that you guys were already in the postseason, so maybe not for this group, but maybe it might have been easy to take your foot off the gas, maybe coast a little bit. But instead, you win by 30 against a team that had to win to get in. So how would you describe the mindset and the attitude of the team going into that game?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, man, if you just watch the game, I mean, you could just see the group of guys that we have in the locker room and just see, you know, the leadership that we have on the team and, you know, how everybody takes it a game at a time. I mean, nobody took their foot off the gas. Everybody was still excited to be out there. I mean, we approach every game like it's our last game. And if you do that, man, you're going to have guys out there flying around, guys playing their balls off and just – I mean, it was spectacular for me to see, you know, just being, you know, one of the leaders on the team and just to see how the guys approached it and just see how hungry we are, man. I think that's, you know, summarize it all, just to see that everybody is still hungry for more. And, I mean, that was a big-time win, you know, right before we get into it with the playoffs. So, I'm excited, man. I know the guys are excited. Everybody in the building is excited to get this thing underway.
Tremaine Edmonds is joining us. I'm glad you mentioned leadership, because the fact of the matter is you're only in your third season. You just turned 22 earlier this year. Most guys your age are not team leaders, but you've been doing that for a while now. And even going into the offseason, you connected with your teammates virtually. You brought guys together. So how would you describe your approach when it comes to leadership?
I lead in different ways. I think one thing about a leader, you got to be able to be open to hear what other people have to say. You know, you got to take constructive criticism from other people and not just think that your way is always right. So, you know, I'm an open guy. I take things that, you know, that I can't always see that other people can see about me or whether it's about the team, and, you know, apply it to whatever it needs to be applied to. But at the same time, you know, using my leadership tactics and making sure I'm leading the guys in the right way, whether it's on the field, working out, or in the meetings, or just, you know, how I carry myself. You know, I think I carry myself as, you know, very professional-like. And, you know, I just try to show the guys that, you know, I'm about business and, you know, I just want to win at the end of the day.
Yeah, Tremaine, you have not been on the show before, so I was really excited to talk to you. But I've had Lorenzo Alexander on the program a number of times, and he and I have always talked about you on the program. He's hyped you up in the past on this show. What was it like to be on the same defense with a vet like that when you first came into the NFL? And what did you learn from him at that time?
Yeah, Zoe's my guy, man. Zoe, he's definitely my guy, you know, coming in as a young guy, just having somebody that you could look up to that does things the right way. I think that's one thing that, you know, a lot of rookies look into when they come into the league. And, you know, Zoe's been around for a very long time, man, and, you know, he's had a lot of success in this league. So just to see somebody around the building, and not just around the building, in my linebacker room, do stuff the right way, I mean, it was just, you know, something great for me to see. And, you know, anytime I had a question, man, Zoe, he didn't hesitate to answer him. And, you know, he would get with me one-on-one, and we would go over things. And just, I mean, he was just a great leader, man. And, you know, I know he had a lot of success with the Bills when I was there. So, you know, just as far as he had a lot of success in the league all around, and just to see a guy like that, man, it takes every day like it's his last day. And, I mean, it shows, man. Even in practice, he goes 100 miles per hour. And in the game, he does the same thing, man. So, I appreciate him for everything he did for me.
We're talking Bills football. Tremaine Edmonds is joining us. Now, the defense is playing really good ball right now. In fact, has been the entire year. But especially of late, the defense has been in the top five in scoring since week 12. It seems like from the outside that the entire unit is playing its best football at the most important time of the year. What is it about this group that makes that defense so special?
Man, I think it's, again, man, I think it's just the guys we have on the team. You know, I think we hold each other accountable, and I think that's one of the biggest things. I mean, you know, anytime somebody's down or whatever, I mean, we're not afraid to, you know, let that person know. And anytime you have that, man, it's something special. And, you know, even at practice, man, we hold each other to a high standard. And, we preach all the time a playoff caliber standard. And when you have that, man, we have guys approaching practice like it's a game. I mean, on everybody's mind, man, it's to get better. And, I mean, when we watch the film as a team, you could just see that. And I think that's what clicks everybody together, especially during this pandemic we have, and we can't really get together outside of the building. It's about what we do while we're in the building together. And just seeing how we gel together at practice and, you know, different things, and seeing guys get out there and competing every day. I mean, I think that speaks measures, and, you know, that's why, you know, we have the success that we have.
You know, we talked about the offseason. You weren't just being a leader in the offseason. You and your brothers were also hitting it really hard when it came to training. You've said that your mother, Felicia, was the one who was pushing all you guys. You said, quote, "I had my mom out there, and she was just killing us, but it was all for the better." What was that like, and what was mom's doing to get you guys ready?
Man, offseason training is definitely tough. I mean, it's one of those things, man, that you look forward to, but at the same time, you don't look forward to it. But, I mean, we was doing a little bit of everything. You know, something that we always do is track workouts. You know, my mom was a track athlete. So, you know, anytime we could do track workouts as far as speed, conditioning, any type, whatever it may be, I mean, those workouts are always tough, man. I mean, I'm pretty sure any track athlete can attest to that. But, I mean, we did a little bit of everything, man. Hills, stadiums, like stairs, field work, drills. I mean, anything you can imagine, man, we did a little bit of everything. So, I mean, and, you know, I said my mom, not just my mom, man, my dad pushes as well. I mean, it's both of them, you know. I just said my mom in particular because she got that track background, man. So anytime we do those track workouts, it's always tough. But just having those workouts with my brothers, man, I mean, the pandemic actually worked out for us because just training with each other, I mean, we got a lot out of it, and we was able to compete with each other and made each other better.
See, I was going to say that. I mean, it was definitely your dad, too, but your brothers. I mean, in a pandemic, when you've got your family, especially your particular family with that kind of athletic background, what about your brothers, Trey and Terrell, working out with you? How much did that motivate you, and then how much do you guys push each other and feed off of each other?
Motivated us a lot, man. I mean, anytime you have your brothers that you've been through everything with and you all training for the same goal, and that's just to be the best, you know, best in your position. And, I mean, anytime you have that and guys with the same mindset as you, I mean, it's always going to be good things come out of it, good results out of everything because, I mean, it's no off days, you know. Even the days that we don't feel like going out there, we push each other to go get it, push each other to, you know, push ourselves, you know, a little bit more than what we did the previous day. So, I mean, like I said, you have those type of guys around you, man. There's no way that you can settle with being average or mediocre, man. You always going to push yourself to be the best you can be.
Tremaine, before I let you go, let me ask you about that point you just made because, you know, at the start of the year, everybody's hyped, everybody's focused. I don't care what you do in life. You're motivated. But you just mentioned something. What do you do on those days when you're not feeling like it? What do you do on those days when you just don't want to go and you know you've got to get the work in? How do you get yourself to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have those days, you know. I mean, we all human. You know, we all wake up some of those days, something hurts. Or, you know, you're just not in the mold. But, I mean, it has to be something that triggers your mind, it triggers your body, that you have to go get it. I mean, I think everybody finds motivation in different ways, you know. So it's hard for me to tell somebody, you know, what gets me up may not get them up, you know. So you have to, I think the biggest thing is have find something that motivates you. And once you find that one thing that motivates you, I think that's what's going to get you up on those days that, you know, you don't really feel like doing it. And, you know, I think that's the biggest thing. You have to look yourself in the mirror. And if you really want something, man, you have to be honest with yourself and say, this is what I'm going to do. This is how far I'm going to go. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you never know how far you can really go. You always got to push yourself to go even further. But biggest thing is just find something that motivates you. And once you find that motivation is going to carry you on through it.
In other words, know your why. All right, one last thought. A limited number of fans are going to be allowed to the game on Saturday. I know it's not the entire stadium, but knowing how passionate the Bills Mafia is, knowing how badly the fans want that, what's it going to mean to have some of them in the stands for that playoff game?
It's going to be amazing, man. We've been wanting fans all year. I think, you know, we were one of the teams throughout the whole entire league that didn't have any fans throughout the whole year. So, I mean, it's going to be amazing. You know, Bills Mafia is one of the best fan bases, you know, I know I've been a part of. So it's going to be amazing to see them out there. I know it's going to be loud. Even with those limited fans we have in there, it's still going to be loud because that's what Bills Mafia brings. So I'm looking forward to it, man. It's going to be a great one.
Listen, Tremaine, one last thought, actually. I know you're focused on the team. I know you're focused on the playoffs, but you were named to your second Pro Bowl this season. You're focused on the team and what's in front of you, but what's that honor mean to you personally?
It means a lot, man. I'm blessed for it. You know, I'm extremely honored, man, just to be, you know, acknowledged by the guys across the league and not just the guys, the coaches and the fans. You know, I really appreciate it. I don't take those things for granted, man, because, you know, I mean, it's just to be looked at that, to be looked as that caliber player by your peers, man, it means a lot. But, I mean, you hit it on the head, like, before you asked me that question. I got my mind on bigger things. You know, I'm happy for the individual awards, but ultimately, man, I want to get that team award, which is the championship. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
My man, I know you don't take that for granted. I don't get the sense you take anything for granted at all. And I mean that in the best way. 119 tackles, 2 sacks. Buffalo is 13-3. They are the AFC Eastern champions. And it all starts again Saturday. Buffalo hosting Indianapolis. Tremaine Edmonds, my guest. Tremaine, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for making time on this Monday. And really good to have you on the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
And you have playoff teams, and then you have playoff teams. There are teams that make the playoffs because somebody's got to make the playoffs to fill out the field. No names mentioned, but you could probably do the math. You have those teams, and then you have playoff teams. You know, the teams for whom making the playoffs is just the beginning. These are teams that are not looking to take part. They're looking to take over. These are the teams that scare you in the postseason. These are the teams that you want no part of. The Buffalo Bills are one of those teams. In fact, if you're making a list of the 3 scariest teams in the postseason, you better put them on the short list. They better be on that list because that's how good they are. And no, that is not me honking for a team in a city that go way back with the jungle. That's me stating facts. Let's look at the facts. An MVP caliber quarterback. who has thrown TD passes to 13 different guys. A defense that is peaking at just the right time. Look the hell out. I mean, there was a time when making the playoffs was a reason to party in Buffalo. But not anymore. They aren't just happy with showing up. They're looking to win the whole damn thing. I can't stress that enough. They're not just happy to be there. They're not just happy to advance. They're looking to win the whole damn thing. You don't believe me? Ask the Miami Dolphins. Miami was a pretty good team that went into yesterday's game needing a win to get to the postseason. And they come out of that game nursing a 30-point beatdown, a 30-point humiliation that was so bad, it literally has people questioning whether or not Tua is the guy going forward. A guy they took in the top five last year. And they're asking whether or not they have to draft another quarterback. That's how bad that was. 55-26. There's your final score. Against a 10-win Dolphin team that could have been a playoff team with a win. 56-26, I should say. That does not happen in the NFL. That happens when a college powerhouse plays a directional. But that's what happened when the Bills showed up yesterday. And they did a lot of that damage with their backups. So that's a team that's not just talented, but they're deep, which I'll get to in a second. Let me run down the last few weeks. Let me talk about what they've done the last few games and in the last few months. 56-26, 38-9, 48-19. Those are the scores of their last three games. So they don't just beat you, they beat you down. Now, you know those. That's got to scare everybody around the NFL, including Kansas City, because Buffalo's got the weapons to compete with Kansas City. And they've gone back to work since that loss to Kansas City back in October. In fact, if you take away that Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins, Hail Murray, Hail Mary, these guys getting freaky on that play, if you take that away, the Bills would be rolling into the postseason with 10 straight wins since that loss to Kansas City. Instead, they've got to settle for 9 of their last 10. I'm telling you, this team is so good. Stephon Diggs was flossing on the sideline in the first half. Literally. He was getting in between his teeth during the game. And the only thing better than Stephon Diggs flossing on the sideline is the GOAT, Kevin Harlan, on the call.
You're focused more on next week.
And his dental hygiene is something to take note of, kids out there. There's never a bad place to floss.
He's right. Normally a stud receiver, dropping a clinic in oral hygiene would be the highlight of the day. Normally, but not yesterday. Not when Isaiah McKenzie turned the second quarter into the Isaiah McKenzie show. Here he is with just over 12 minutes left in that quarter.
Here's the snap. Josh looking to throw. Fires into the end zone. Caught. Touchdown. Isaiah McKenzie. Touchdown, Buffalo.
Bills radio. Then here he is about 5 minutes later.
The snap. Josh Allen. Flag goes down at the snap. Josh takes a long time. Looks into the end zone. McKenzie's there. It is caught. Touchdown. It is Isaiah McKenzie again.
McKenzie having himself a day in the second quarter alone. And then less than 2 minutes after that.
Pretty good looking punt. McKenzie backpedaling.
Uh-oh.
Fields it at the 16-yard line. Dodges two men. Starts up the middle. Now to the right side at the 30. At the 40. Isaiah McKenzie on the run at midfield in Miami territory. Got to beat the punter. He gets around him. He's at the 20. He's at the 15, 10, 5. Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown, Buffalo! Isaiah McKenzie goes 84 yards for the touchdown. He's got three touchdowns today.
Good night, Miami!
Wow.
This is the Isaiah McKenzie show here in the first half for Buffalo.
Not only three touchdowns, but three touchdowns in less than 7 minutes of game time, which is pretty unreal. You know what else is unreal? This exchange between McKenzie and Josh Allen that took place before the punt return. Check out McKenzie.
Right before that, I was telling Josh, I said, Josh, don't worry about it. I'm a score. And he's like, well, go ahead then. And I'm like, all right, cool.
So he's getting ready to go back on the field. And he says, don't worry about that. I'm going to score. And Josh Allen said, well, go ahead then. And then McKenzie did just that. He went right on ahead. And that would sum up this team this year. Go ahead then. And then they do it. In the past, the Bills, like they were this lovable team with the fanatical fan base. But now they're the scary as hell team with the fanatical fan base. McKenzie said after the game, quote, "Seeing how we've grown so much from 2018 to 2020 has been a tremendous change. In 2018, people were like, it's just the Buffalo Bills. Now it's 2020, and people are like, we have to worry about the Buffalo Bills. It's been awesome just being here and trusting the process. It's really been a process," end quote. Hey, listen, if I'm talking about this team, you know I'm going to check in and see how Deion Dawkins describes it. Quote, "It just shows that this is a different Buffalo Bills football team. We don't have to get in on anybody's back. This is all our doing. And it feels good to kick the front door out and sweep the East." End of quote. They did sweep the East. They kicked serious ass. And now this is your official warning. The rest of y'all have been put on notice because the playoffs are starting and the Bills Mafia are coming. Prepare accordingly. And they're letting some of the Mafia in. Bills Mafia, I'm going to ask you yet again. I've done so on social. I've done so on Twitter. I've done it on this show. I'm going to ask you yet again. How y'all living? How y'all feeling? How do y'all feel about what you're seeing? What's it all feel like after all of this? To not only be there, to not only be in, to not only be in position to do some damage, but to be in position to maybe run the table. They're that good. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender, and it's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors: old-fashioned, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy. So next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for it in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying that way. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Pat Forty. Pat, Happy New Year. Good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, great to be on with you again. Happy New Year to you.
You too. Pat, great to talk to you as always. A lot to talk about in college football. Pat, let me start with your piece from over the weekend where Texas fired Tom Herman, replaced him with Steve Sarkisian. Given that just 3 weeks earlier, Pat, Texas gave its support to Herman, what was your reaction when you heard that he had been fired?
I was very surprised. Perhaps I was a bit naive because looking back, the statement of support for Tom Herman was very unenthusiastic. I mean, it was the bare minimum of he's our coach. That was basically it, and that was probably a sign. But still, Jim, you know, the thing that stood out to me is they made that announcement 5 days before signing day. They signed a class, a top 20 class of recruits, and then they basically pulled a bait and switch on them. And, you know, they pulled out they fired the coach, fired the staff, and they're going to now have an entirely different staff. And I think it's beholden to them to release those kids from their letters of intent and let them decide whether they want to sign with the new staff or not. So that and the cost involved, $24 million to buy out Tom Herman and his staff, given the fact that we're in a pandemic that's crushing budgets everywhere, including at the University of Texas, it's a really bad look, I think, for Texas.
We're talking to Pat Forty. Pat, to that point, I mean, it's the $24, $25 million to buy him and the staff out. But as you point out, the entire coaching change is going to cost probably upwards of $40 to $50 million when you factor in Sarkisian and his staff, all during a pandemic. And shortly after, that department had to lay off 35 people. I mean, what's that say about the athletic department at Texas and the boosters at Texas?
Well, it says they got a lot of money, for one thing.
Right?
I mean, you know, they're rolling in revenues during normal times, and they've got a lot of other boosters with a lot of money. But that also means that they get to say what happens to a degree. And if they decide that Tom Herman's not doing well enough for their taste, then he's out and somebody else is in. And, you know, if you're one of those people, if you were working in on the maintenance staff and you got laid off, if you were working in media relations and got laid off, if you were a secretary and you got your pay cut and they turn around and do this, I would think you'd have a pretty bitter taste in your mouth, because maybe the athletic director should ask some of the fat cap boosters, say, hey, thanks for the $50 million here so we can do this, but how about another million so we can give these people back their jobs? You know, that's where the too-big-to-fail aspect of football, especially at places like Texas, can be a little bit off-putting at times.
We're talking to Pat Forte. Well said. So, Pat, looking back, why do you think that things did not work out for Herman at Texas?
You know, I'm really surprised because I thought 5 years ago when he was at Houston and when Steve Sarkisian was being fired at USC that, you know, Tom Herman's star was ascending and we weren't sure whether we'd ever hear of Steve Sarkisian again. So, you know, things change. But mostly I think Herman came in, while he understood Texas, I'm not sure he understood the importance of having alliances with important people at Texas. And then, you know, I think he figured his teams would just win and it didn't really matter. But when you didn't necessarily win 11 or 12 games, then if you weren't buddies with people, that was a problem. And his teams were talented, but they just kept making key mistakes at key times. They never really established a consistent excellence. They were basically just another team in the Big 12 every year. You know, every game was 7 points this way, 7 points that way. They just never fully exerted utilized the talent that they had.
So now they move on. Pat Forte is joining us. Pat, you made the point and the argument that if Texas were hiring Urban Meyer, then it might make sense to move on for Herman, especially at that cost. But how big of an upgrade, Pat, is Sark over Herman?
Don't know. You know, we'll see. I mean, that's the thing. With Urban, you can feel pretty certain that you were going to have a national title contender quickly because that's the track record. Sark hadn't been a head coach in 5 years. When he was, his record was kind of underwhelming. I mean, you know, he had a 9-4 season at USC, which is kind of ho-hum, you know, and when USC is on rolling well. And then he gets fired. And look, you know, for his sake, you hope it's a great redemption story. And he had some personal problems, and he's put those behind him. And he's done very good work at Alabama. But you're also working with the greatest head coach in history in Nick Saban, and with superior talent to anyone in the nation. So at Texas, you have chance to have superior talent, but right now you don't. And so what's he going to do with the hand that he has dealt and the hand that he can recruit? We don't know. It's totally jury out, I think.
We're talking to Pat Forte. Before I let you go, Pat, and I appreciate your thoughts on that story. What about the semifinal and the final itself? How impressed, for instance, were you with the way Ohio State showed up in the second semifinal, especially given how they had looked throughout the season?
Yeah, I was blown away, Jim. I just really was. I thought that I didn't think they could win, and I thought they may even get trucked a bit by Clemson just because I thought Clemson was playing at a much higher level. And then Ohio State just stepped it up three levels, you know, and the way they executed, the way they performed, Justin Fields, really one of the great performances I've seen from a quarterback, especially after nearly having his ribcage split in half. You know, just courageous and brilliant. Their defense played better. Trey Sermon has been a monster lately. Their receivers are excellent. Their offensive line is excellent. So they've got the parts, and I think it's going to be a real shootout in the final with Alabama.
Pat Forte, my guest. I mean, an amazing win for Ohio State and an amazing performance. What about Clemson? What about the flip side? How bad of a loss was that for Clemson?
It was bad. It was especially bad for Dabo Swinney, you know, who ran his mouth a bit. And, you know, if you hand out that bulletin board material of putting Ohio State 11th and know that's going to be public, and then you go out and get run over, that's a bad look. And, you know, Dabo's had a great, great run, and it's going to continue. They've got really good players, but you lose Trevor Lawrence, and even though the next quarterback is really talented, he may not be Trevor Lawrence. And, you know, it's just a situation where they've had a great, as I said, a great run, but you may have missed a little bit of a window here with Trevor. They should probably still be a top five program. They may eventually be a national champion again, but you wonder if the last 2 years, if they maybe missed a chance to add a second or third national title under Trevor Lawrence.
Hey, Pat, before I ask you about the final, really quickly, when you look at the landscape right now and college football for the past few years, I mean, the sport really is about three teams, right? Bama, Clemson, Ohio State, then maybe finding a fourth team to round out the field. If that's the case, how big of a problem is that for the sport, and is that something that can actually be changed?
I don't think it's good. I really don't. You know, I mean, college football is a great national sport when everybody can be involved. And right now, I mean, there's diminished interest, I think, on the West Coast because the West Coast isn't competitive. In the Midwest and upper Midwest and even to the Northeast, it's Ohio State and nobody else, basically. Notre Dame can get there but can't compete. And, yeah, as you said, it's a three-team sport at this point. And I just think that everything's better when it's a little bit bigger tent, you know, and more people are involved, more people say, hey, we've got a chance this year. When you're going into a season saying, nah, only three teams have a chance, that's just not good.
No doubt. All right, Pat, finally then, what about the matchup in the championship game? For instance, what kind of a game are you expecting, and does Ohio State's best beat Alabama's best?
A lot of points, I expect. You know, I think that when these two played in the semifinals in 2014, it was 42-35. I think it's going to be higher scoring than that. We've got great quarterbacks. We've got ridiculous receivers. We've got ridiculous running backs. We've got great coaches, you know, big brands, big traditions, big braggers. You know, I mean, there's a lot of arrogance that goes in with these two programs into this. So, I mean, it's going to be a fun build-up to it. You know, I think Ohio State can win. I still favor Alabama. You know, this may be a small point, but one thing that stood out to me, Alabama dispatched Notre Dame as expected and acted like, okay, next. Ohio State dispatched Clemson and, somewhat understandably, kind of went crazy afterwards. I mean, they were celebrating big time. The defensive coordinator, Kerry Combs, is doing confetti angels on the field. No Nick Saban assistants are doing something like that after a semifinal win. And so you kind of wonder how big a bullet Ohio State shot and what's the reload capability here, whereas Alabama, I think, is just like, yep, we're ready for the next game right now.
Really interesting point. He is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, a co-host of the Yahoo Sports College podcast, which is an excellent listen. He is Pat Forty. Pat, always good to have you on the show. Great job, as always. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you, Romy. Appreciate it.
The Cleveland Browns are in the playoffs. America's team, right back where it belongs. And the play that made it official so perfectly summed up the Browns team that I've got to run it right here, right now. Third down, just over a minute to go. Cleveland holding on to a two-point lead. You pick up that first down, you're going to the playoffs. You come up short, you need to punt, and then you've got a lot more tension than you probably want. So what do? Do you hand it to one of your elite backs? They've got the best 1-2 punch in the backfield in the NFL. Do you do that? No. You give it to America's quarterback instead and let him do it himself. Roll it.
Mayfield takes the snap. He's going to run it to the right. Mayfield turns the corner and got the first down on the right side. He slides inside the 40-yard line. It's a first down, and that bench area is starting to feel it right now. And wherever you are, this is starting to become very, very real that the Browns are going to go to the playoff.
Hell yes, Browns radio. Baker Mayfield turning it into a runner again. Turns himself into a runner again. First down, they're on to the postseason. And to me, everything about that was so badass. Everything. The call was badass. The execution was badass. The quarterback is badass. Yes, I said it. The quarterback wasn't even sure that that was really the call when it came in. Check out Baker.
I heard the play call on the sideline when I was over. Case Keenum told me, I thought he was joking at first because I didn't hear it from Kevin, but then he called it, you know, I was like, you know what, let's go do it, you know, whatever it takes, and obviously a great call.
Sure as hell was a great call. Everything about yesterday was great for Cleveland. And you know what we're not going to do today? We're not going to talk about how this Browns team is not that or this. We're not going to talk down about this Browns team and what they've accomplished. We're just not doing it because it's crap. If that's your take, keep on moving. You are not welcome here. I'm not interested in all you haters and losers who want to say something about how Cleveland did not exactly dominate the Steelers JV team. It doesn't matter. They won the game. They're in. The Browns are in the playoffs. The Cleveland freaking Browns are in the freaking playoffs. And they didn't back in. They went head first. They had to go through a brick wall to get there. Think about it. They won 11 games this year. They did it with a first-year head coach. They did it with a first-year GM. They did it in the middle of a pandemic. Do you have any idea how tough that is? They lost Odell Beckham Jr. They kept right on rolling. They lost one player after another to COVID. They found a way to win. Hell, Nick Chubb missed four games this year and still had more than 1,000 yards and 12 TDs on the season. He missed a quarter of the year, and he still dominated. Yesterday, he was still doing stuff like this.
Takes the snap, gives it, Chubb runs, dips his shoulders, he's to the 40, 35, he's to the 30, cut back 25, he's to the 15, 10, 5, touchdown! Nick Chubb, he's over 1,000, and the Browns lead 6-0.
And if you think that I'm going to do an entire take on the Browns and the playoffs and not talk about jungle legend Austin Hooper, you better think again, because he clutched up again.
First down and goal at the 1.5. Chubb in the backfield. Mayfield turns. He's going to throw. He's looking. Left sideline. Caught. Touchdown. It's Austin Hooper.
My guy. Look, there's a Pro Bowler right there who's averaging better than 70 receptions per season the last 2 years. Then he comes to Cleveland, and he shows how great he is as a blocker. Like, everybody wants to talk about culture. Everybody wants to talk about a winning mentality. But that's what that is. We over me, putting the team first. And that's what this group does. Here's the other thing. And a lot of the haters don't want to accept this or acknowledge this. Man, they're tough as hell. They are. They're as tough as the fans they represent. So we're not going to be talking any kind of junk about how long it's been since they were in the playoffs. We're not going to be talking about the songs and the movies that were hits the last time they were in the playoffs. We're not going to talk about what the old Cleveland Browns would have done or how the old Browns would have lost to the Jets last week and then found a way to bomb their way out of the postseason. We're not doing that. Just like we're not going to talk about the number of head coaches they've had or the number of quarterbacks they've gone through. Because none of that crap matters now. They have their head coach now. They've got their quarterback now. And they're going to the playoffs now. And they did it in the toughest year ever. I'm feeling so good about this. Man, I'm feeling so good about this that I'm not even going to bother to say, I told you so. Even though I did tell you so. I'm not here to keep score. I'm not here to read off a list of the haters and the losers who thought that I was insane and talking out my ass and didn't know what I was talking about at all when I said that this group was America's team or when I told you how good they would be. I could. I have every right to, but I'm not doing it. Just like Baker and I and the rest of the Browns are not going to point at the scoreboard or the standings today because that's not what we're about. We're changing the paradigm. We're not saying how you like us now. We're not doling out Crow Sandos and chasing it with slices of humble pie. We don't have to. That's the old way of thinking. We're not doing that anymore because these are not the old Cleveland Browns. These are the new Cleveland Browns. And they're not just going to the playoffs. They're giving hope to the entire world. When you look at these Cleveland Browns, remember, you're looking at a team that was 1-31 just 3 years ago, and they've completely turned it around. They went from America's punchline to America's team. And if they can turn it around and they can overcome obstacles, you can do that in your life too. Man, what a great way to start a new year with America's team in the playoffs and providing inspiration to everybody. Believe it. Look at America's team. Then look in the mirror and know there's always hope. Man, there's always hope. It's America's team right there. I'm extremely proud, but not surprised. Not at all. He is Michael Lombardi. Michael, Happy New Year. Good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Happy New Year to you, too. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you. Great to have you, Michael. So, last time you were on, we talked about Greg Williams calling that blitz on the final play against the Raiders. Last night, Michael, Doug Peterson inserts former third stringer Nate Sudfeld into a one-score game. Before we get into that, what do you make of how Peterson handled the clock at the end of the first half?
You read my mind, Jim.
Good.
I mean, you read my mind. I mean, I don't understand. Of course, it never got brought up on the on television, but you know, when you get the ball with under 2 minutes to go in the half and you know your opponent has the ball to start the second half, you have to somehow control the middle eight. And controlling the middle eight is a little bit like chess. Whoever has the white pieces in chess usually wins. Whoever controls the middle eight usually wins. And if you kick off to start the game, that means you've given your opponent the white pieces. And the middle eight allows you to get them back. And so Doug gets the ball with under 2 minutes to go, He knows Washington has three timeouts left. He chooses to throw three consecutive passes starting at 1:52 to go in the half. And in 15 seconds later, he's punting the ball back to Washington with three timeouts in their arsenal, with the ability to score, and also with the ability to get the ball to start the second half. So he's completely done it. But this is typical of what they've always done in Philadelphia under Doug Peterson, including the year they won the Super Bowl where they overcame it, is they have no regard to play complementary football or pay attention to the details that ultimately give your team a chance to win.
We're talking to Michael Lombardi. So, Michael, I would ask you your reaction when you saw Sudfeld enter the game, but take me back even further. What went through your mind when you saw Philadelphia had activated him last week? What did that tell you about what Peterson was looking to do?
It told me all. I said it on my show, The Lombardi Line on VSiN. I said it Sunday morning. When they activated Sudfeld, I knew he was going to put him in the game for two reasons. One, he was worried about Jalen Hurts getting hit because he couldn't protect because his offensive line was so beat up. And two, he wasn't going to put Wentz in that situation because he was going to forfeit the game in the second half. I was surprised he played Hurts as long as he did. I knew they'd rather have the sixth pick in the draft than the ninth because that's how they think in Philadelphia. That's why they go for it so much on fourth down. Like, I don't know why we're getting upset about them wanting the draft pick when they've showed us who they are through the whole time. I mean, anybody with any common sense that goes for it as much as Philadelphia does, but ranks 25th in the league in fourth down conversions, you would probably say to yourself, maybe we shouldn't go for it as much as we do. But yet they continue to do it. So Michael, they're all driven by analytics, which is fine, which is wonderful, but the reality of it is sometimes you got to pay attention to what the numbers are.
We're talking to Michael Lombardi. You know, Michael, to your point, obviously the sixth pick is much better than the ninth pick. But what do you make of Peterson's explanation for getting Sudfeld into the game? Because, quote, he had been around for 4 years and he deserved the snaps.
Well, you know, when my kids went to school in California at the Catholic school, they played Little League. Everybody had to play in Little League. The NFL is a Little League. Like, nobody, not everybody has to play. Sudfeld gets paid a salary whether he gets to play or not. Like, I'm not trying to make everybody happy. I'm trying to win games, you know? I mean, the reality of the situation is that's one of the worst excuses I could have ever heard. Like, is he running a party? Is he running a Little League baseball team that he wants to put the kid out in right field so he gets some reps? Like, it makes no sense to me why you would do it. What makes no sense is why the networks put that game on at the end of the year. We knew they had nothing to play for in Philly. We knew it. Poor Al Michaels had to fly all the way across the country. He missed dinner at Toscano's to watch that.
That's funny. He loves Toscano's too. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I said myself watching that game, Michael, I can only imagine what Al said when he took the headphones off and that thing was over. But like, what about this point? The point that you make, I'm curious, what's that do to the dynamic in the locker room? When you see Eagle players out there and they're trying to win and then Sudfeld goes into the game, what kind of a damage might that do inside the locker room? Like, is that something that just goes away or does that stay with guys? Do they remember that?
Oh, I think they remember it, and I think they feel like somebody's pulling Doug's strings. Now, he went out of his way to say that it was his decision, but does it look like his decision? You know, does it really look like that's what he wanted to do? Or was somebody telling him what to do? You know, he went out of his way to say it was strictly his. He fell on the sword, but of course he knows he's coming back, so it was easier to fall on the sword. But the reality of it is I have no problem if the Eagles would have been honest up front and started stuff up in the beginning of the game. If that's what they wanted to do, that's their prerogative. They could have done it. But don't play into this mythology that they were trying to win. Who goes for it on 4th and 5 with 2 minutes to go in the third quarter in a game that supposedly matters and you turn down the points? I get John Gruden going for 2 against Denver. It's the end of the year. Both teams are going nowhere. Let's just end it right now. Okay, they won. Denver didn't. I don't get going for it. And then the line of the night, Jim, was when Al Michaels says, when Chris Collinsworth is trying to defend going for it on 4th and 5 from the 5-yard line, Al Michaels says, I'd like to see that math. Because, like, what is that math that tells you to turn down 3 points to tie a game going in the fourth quarter?
Right, right. Show me the placard. Show me that chart which says that's the right thing to do. Michael Lombardi is joining us. Michael, so one more thought about Carson Wentz and then the Eagles, because you've got the reports that he wants out, that the relationship between Wentz and Peterson is beyond repair. Like, what's your reaction to that report, and how do you see that relationship playing out?
I think this damages it even more. I mean, you saw after the game, Jason Kelce and Ertz are all on the field kind of like talking like this is going to be their final goodbye. I mean, obviously, I was wrong in the sense that I thought at the end of the year, Doug Peterson was going to have to explain to Jeff Lurie how he was going to fix Wentz. But now it seems like they're not even trying to fix Wentz. They're going to deal Wentz. That their concern is, at least we get the sixth pick. Maybe we'll pick a quarterback up here. Maybe we'll do something different. I think, to me, Wentz is broken. He's got $40 million of guaranteed money. They're going to have to be very creative in how they do it. Why would he give any money back? And then my question is, everybody thinks he's going to Indy. Why would Chris Ballard, of the GM of the Colts, want to take on their problem?
Do you think he can be fixed?
That's a hard question for me. The year he won the MVP, he was sensational. Now, let's put this in perspective. The year they went to the Super Bowl in 2017, they were the seventh worst team in the National Football League that year in accumulating third and sevens or more. They were in the company of some of the worst offenses in football that year. Now, what they were remarkable at was converting third and sevens at a 50% rate, which was unheard of in the NFL. Unheard of. They were able to do that. And that's how they were able to win. They had this unique ability to make plays at the critical time. And Wentz was responsible for a lot of those plays. I don't know if it'll come back again. He looks like a boxer that's gotten hit too much, and his accuracy is bad, and he just doesn't feel comfortable. He's playing a game that he doesn't seem like he's enjoying playing right now.
Michael Lombardi is joining us. All right, Michael, before I let you go, what about Wild Card Weekend? You've got the Browns that are back in the postseason. They're going up against Pittsburgh. They'll play them a third time this year. How do you see that game going?
Well, I think this is all about, can the Browns play from in front? I think the Browns are a great team when they can play from in front. When their run game can be the lead, when they have to throw it like they did against the Jets 53 times, that's not Mayfield's game. They've got to play from in front. This first quarter for the Browns is the most critical. They've got to get ahead. Last time they played Pittsburgh, they got the ball to start the game. They threw a pick six to Fitzpatrick. The game was over quickly. Pittsburgh moved the ball down the field, and they got behind, and they can't get back. Cleveland is a good offense, much like Minnesota last year. They have to play from in front. They've got to be able to be balanced. Mayfield's got to throw the ball 30 times or less on bootlegs and nakeds. And I think losing Olivier Vernon really hurts them. They lose an edge rusher. They lose an edge setter. I think that's an injury that the Browns are going to have a hard time overcoming. But they can. If they can play from in front with their run game, they can be a force to beat the Steelers.
We are talking to Michael Lombardi for a few more moments. Michael, I'm really curious what your thoughts are on this. The Bills hammered Miami yesterday, and, of course, the Dolphins have the third pick in the draft. They've got Tua, but Tua did not have the smoothest season, and now there's speculation about what they might do with that pick. How would you approach it? Like, do you think they've got their quarterback of the future, or do you kick the tires on one of the quarterbacks who's in the draft?
You know, I would take Tua and watch him and see what he's done. Now, I mean, anybody who watches him sees that he doesn't have elite arm strength. He doesn't have elite speed. He doesn't have elite size. And so you're counting on these intangibles. You know, he has the it factor. Well, you know, he doesn't throw the ball down the field. Is that because he's a new player and he's just feeling himself out? He's inexperienced? Or is that just because he doesn't want to throw it down the field? He doesn't trust his arm to get it down the field, or he doesn't see the receivers? And then you've got to compare him to whichever one of these players is coming out in the draft, not counting Lawrence, assuming he does come out, not counting Lawrence. Then I think you make that decision yourself. If you think Fields is significantly better than Tua, you better take him. The question you must answer if you're the Miami Dolphins is, who will be our starting quarterback in 2024, and does he give us a chance to be a Super Bowl winner?
Michael Lombardi joining us. So, Michael, when you see Buffalo dominating Miami's backups, or dominating with their backups, I should say, on the field, how much does that tell you about the attitude and the confidence and the depth of this Bills team?
I thought it was impressive. I thought that they had that swagger. They put a bunch of guys in there. They bought into the culture. You could feel it. They were very comfortable. This is going to be a huge challenge for Indianapolis to go there. I mean, we know the temperature is going to be less than 40 degrees. And Rivers, in his long, long career, has not played to a level in those 17 games he's participated in under 40 degrees at the highest level. This is going to be a game they've got to be able to run the football to beat Buffalo, because Buffalo is playing at such a high level right now. And I love what McDermott did. He played his players. He kept their confidence going as they go into to get preparation for the next game. And I think that was a smart thing to do. They're a deadly team. They're a hard team to play because of what he brings to them. I've never seen a player improve his accuracy like Josh Allen, and he's done it remarkably.
Right. And also, Michael, I had Tremaine Edmonds on earlier in the program, and he throws off the same swagger that you were talking about. I mean, teams always talk about culture and process, but it's so clear that the Bills have that and they believe. Really quickly, before you go, I want to ask you about something you wrote about recently. A number of teams are looking for GMs, and you had a piece in The Athletic about this case that pairing a GM and a head coach is not nearly as tough as some organizations make it look. What are the keys to having a good GM and coach relationship?
Well, I think the coach has got to really see the big picture. He can't be the play caller and not care what happens on the special teams. He's got to see the big picture. He has to behave like a head coach. And when you get that partnership with a GM, and then you can deliver the match the players with the plays, find players that fit the scheme like they have in Cleveland. It's perfect. You see it work. Baker Mayfield's not the greatest player in the league, but that scheme fits him perfectly. That's the relationship, and it has to be on a macro level, not a micro level. It's got to be big, and the coach has got to see the game for the whole game. And when you look at Las Vegas, Gruden he only sees the game through the offensive eyes, not as the big picture, which is why some of his draft picks haven't worked out.
You know, to that point, really quickly, in terms of the Raiders, you also made a really interesting point in another piece when you wrote that when you work for Al Davis, he used to say he is not interested in getting a little better. What did he mean by that? And then how did that inform the way the organization approached everything else?
Well, he felt like if we had a player that was a good player and another guy that was in the draft was just a good player, why would we exchange him? It would cost us time and money to make the guy who's good be just as good as the guy we're letting go. He wanted to reach for greatness. He wanted somebody to come in that was significantly better. So when he's looking at the draft, he would want a guy. You know, he had Mark Wilson on the team. He had Jim Plunkett. He wanted John Elway. That's what he wants. He didn't want Tony Eason. He wanted somebody significantly better than the players he had. That's how he always viewed it, and especially at a marquee position. I mean, that's what he always would want. So for him to trade Derek Carr for someone else, that player better be significantly better than Carr.
He is an NFL insider for The Athletic. He is co-host of the GM Shuffle podcast. He is an author. He is a three-time Super Bowl winner, Michael Lombardi. Michael, appreciate you. Great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim. Anytime.
Rod in Florida. It's good to have you, Rod. How are you?
Doing good. How you doing, Jim?
Good. Great.
I'm calling about the Browns, man. I've been a fan since '64. I'm tortured what I am. Scarred, tortured. Cardiac kid from the 80s. You know how it goes.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
My man.
Not a very good call.
You're tortured, or were you being tortured during that phone call? You're tortured emotionally, or you were being physically tortured in the midst of that phone call? My man, you're in the postseason. You won 11 games. You're a real thing. They're America's team. My man, you're scarred, you're tortured, you've been a fan since '64, or you were being waterboarded during that phone call?
Good night now!